I am naturally an introvert person, so I was completely intimidated by the eloquence and positioning of the conversation. And after a number of meetings, I realized if I really forget about the style and the credentials of the persons around me, and I solely concentrate on the topic, then my inhibition goes away. And still today, I get prepared, but I don't get intimidated in any way by roles, by personal equities, by styles. I look at everybody as equal. I just concentrate on what would I do if this is my business. And that's how I overcome inhibition, introversion. In the business world, if you don't find your mechanism to convey your ideas, then you don't bring the best of yourself and you diminish your possibilities.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Ruman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer. Ruman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like being a fly on the wall for my mentoring coffees.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Julio Nemeth, who is the Chief Product Supply Officer at P&G. It was a great conversation about creating ownership within an organization. Here's a quick bio. Julio Nemeth is the Chief Product Supply Officer at Procter & Gamble, where he leads P&G's global product supply organization, including procurement, engineering, manufacturing, and so much more. Julio joined P&G in 1990 as a site engineer for the beauty business in Brazil, and throughout his career has worked in engineering, plant and business operations, and product supply. He has led and supported P&G's businesses around the world, facilitated by his fluency in four languages. In 2015, Julio was elected President, Global Business Services. And outside of P&G, Julio recently joined the board of directors of the Boston Beer Company, Incorporated. Julio received his Bachelor of Science in Naval Engineering from the University of Buenos Aires and his MBA from FGV in Brazil. What I love about our conversation with Julio is his focus on continual improvement. Maybe it's his background in naval engineering, but he spent his entire career finding ways to improve in a variety of different aspects, both in the work itself and in his career. And perhaps that's informed from his childhood, as he shared the story of the lessons he learned from his grandfather who served in World War I. I think we all have those people in our lives who leave a lasting impression on us and shape what we do today. For me, it's my mom. Her sense of humor and appreciation for humor is clearly seen in the work that I do today when working with organizations on the value of humor and in how I present. All of the things that I talk about are what I would consider rated mom, which means I would want my mom comfortable hearing whatever it is that I said or did on any type of platform or any type of stage. For Julio, he does a great job of interweaving stories from his life and his career with lessons that he's learned during that 30-plus year career at P&G, where he still is. And he's including important lessons, including one that he learned when making the big move from Brazil to U.S. with the companies, one that saw him oversee 10x in terms of revenue for the groups that he was working on. But what is really unique about this conversation is that Julio is still at P&G, and he's able to give us a peek behind the curtain on what the company is doing in product supply, including how they managed to increase production with fewer staff during the pandemic and why they're partnering with EY to license that methodology. So it's a very unique conversation for a future P&G alum, but current P&G employee. We think you're going to enjoy it. So let's dive right in with our conversation with Julio. Today, we're talking to Julio Nemeth, the Chief Product Supply Officer at P&G. Julio, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. I am happy to be here.
We are very excited to be chatting with you. Now, some people may already know your professional story. You've got quite the experience at P&G. You started first in site engineering in Brazil, and then you've gained experience in plant and business operations, as well as engineering, and of course, in product supply. You've also worked in a number of different countries and now lead an organization of more than 58,000 people. So my first question for you is, when you were growing up in Buenos Aires, is this the career that you imagined that you would have?
Well, I never imagined when I was growing up that I could have a career like this. Neither did I imagine when I started to work that I could have this type of a responsibility and the opportunity to interact with 58,000 people in 100 countries. My ambition was, when I started to work in Brazil in particular, to get to a level where you are a manager that has a company car. That was my aspiration, because that was what people who were very successful have been able to accomplish. And then in my mind, just getting to that managerial level, which in P&G would be a band 3 level, that would have been a complete success. And I was working very hard to get there. I never thought at that point in time how much more could come.
That is impressive. And so even before, one, I like that criteria of like, okay, if I have a company car, that means I've gotten to a certain point. But before that, even kind of before P&G was on your radar, do you remember what you wanted to grow up to be, like when you were a little kid, what you wanted to grow up to become?
Well, I wanted to design ships and boats. That's why I went to study naval architecture and marine engineering in Argentina. What happened was, by the time I finished my career, the last shipyard in the country was about to close the doors.
Oh, wow.
So, and the country was, as it has been since then, in constant recessions and turmoils. So I abandoned the intention to be on the naval industry. I moved to Brazil. And in Brazil, I started to work for a petrochemical company. And to a large extent, what you find on a petrochemical plant is very much what you find within the machine deck of a ship, right? So that was, let's say, the analogy. Obviously, I was still aspiring at some point in time to design ships and boats, but then life took me into supply chain and I got extraordinarily excited about it. And the dynamic of CPG, the innovation that comes here, the responsibilities, and everything that came with working for P&G and growing made me extraordinarily excited about where I am.
I think that, well, it's fascinating because I think we've talked to a number of different people for the podcast, and you were the first one who was like, I wanted to design ships when I was growing up. So I think it's a fascinating passion, I think, to have an interesting kind of leads you on this journey to naval engineering, which then leads into industry, which then leads into product supply. And so as you were thinking about designing ships when you were a kid, are there any meaningful lessons from your childhood, from parents or grandparents or teachers, or anything happened that still kind of informs who you are today?
Yeah, a person who was extraordinarily I lost my father when I was a child, 11 years old. And my grandfather, who lived in our home, is the one that I would say took the role to guide me and my brother. And he was a very brave man. He was a man that went to World War I at age 14. At age 19, he was a war veteran, lost his leg on the war, and at age 22, got in a boat to make America and came from Hungary to Buenos Aires. So his notion of what are real challenges versus what are insignificant small things in life was very refreshing. And he was constantly telling myself and my brother stories about his own life, his youth, and always encouraging us to just think big about what do we want to do, what do we want to accomplish, what are the real things that mean something, and not being intimidated by small problems and small things that are rather noise than the reality that affects your life. And so he was very influential.
Yeah, you're right. It puts it into a different type of perspective when kind of one of the people that you are growing up with, yeah, has those challenges, 14 going into war, losing a limb, making their way to Buenos Aires. So quite the perspective. I can see that can certainly help frame that. And I love that idea of not being intimidated by these smaller things and focusing on the bigger picture. So you started your career at P&G as a site engineer in beauty care in Brazil. And so I'm curious, with that background of wanting to design ships and kind of being in the petrochemical area, was the, your first role at P&G what you expected? Did you enjoy it, not enjoy it?
It's interesting because before joining P&G, I worked 3 years on the petrochemical industry for the Union Carbide Corporation, that was a very strong chemical company at the time. And I worked on a petrochemical plant. Then I went to business school to Fundação Getúlio Vargas, which is a very, very good business school in Brazil. And at business school, I learned a lot about P&G. So when P&G came in Brazil and started to recruit, that's when I applied because of what I learned at the business school. And I joined P&G as a site engineer, as you mentioned, on a small plant in Sao Paulo. And I was happy for joining a company that was setting the pace for business models, for branding, for innovation with the consumers. But the plant to which I went to work was a small fraction of the petrochemical plant in which I was working before. So from a, I would say, engineering perspective, I was shocked. I said, this is a small thing, right? So how could I left behind all that petrochemical world? What we have all here would fit on a room of the utilities area. But then soon after, the dynamic, the projects, P&G was growing in Brazil, the amount of autonomy and the amount of decision-making power to implement things and to bring technology and automation and processes and new products into the market made it extraordinarily exciting. The pace was completely different.
I mean, two things that stand out to me is that, yeah, if you're reading about a certain company in your business classes, and then suddenly that one's like, hey, we're going to do some recruiting, probably pretty exciting, but really funny, that juxtaposition of thinking, well, we've read about these in school, and then now it's a much smaller plant than what you had worked in before. But to your point of then, okay, there, that means that there's growth opportunities. There's opportunity and autonomy within that. And so I'm curious, from those early days or some of those early roles, are there any lessons that stand out to you that prepared you for the challenges that you're facing today? Anything that you still look back on?
Yeah, there were a couple of things from the early days, and I keep telling these stories if you want, and the implication of those to my people here in P&G. So in the initial years, I am naturally an introvert person. What I mean is, if there is a big party and my friends are there and there are another 100 people in the party, I will spend the time with my friends, not with the additional 100. Right? Probably I will leave the party without getting to know anyone else because I feel comfortable with my folks. And I'm, as I say, an introvert. So I started to work in P&G and I needed to go to the general office. And there were members on that early organization in Brazil that had a very, I would say, sophisticated ability to speak English very well, very high level of education. So in the initial meetings that I was going into, I was completely intimidated by the eloquence of the words and the positioning of things. And I would say the conversation that was going on. So I was more than quiet because I thought, wow, I mean, everybody is so impressive. And after a number of meetings, I realized that there was a lot more on the talk than on the substance. And I started to figure that if I really forget about the credentials and the style and I would say even the level of the persons that are around me on the room, and I solely concentrate on the topic of the discussion, and if I put in my mind the notion that I own this business, what would I do on this situation? Then my inhibition goes away. And I started to use this mechanism. Now I'm talking 25, 28 years ago, and I still do it today. When I get to interact, and it's a lot, internally, externally, with people, with the board, in the other board in which I sit, I do two things. Thing number one is I get prepared, but I don't get concerned at all with the individuals that are around me. So not to be intimidated in any way by roles, by personal equities, by styles. So I look at everybody as equal ground. And point number two, I just concentrate on what would I do if this is my business, regardless on which role I am, if this is my business. And that's how I overcome inhibition, introversion. And in a social world, you are allowed and you are okay to be introvert. On the business world, if you don't speak up, if you don't find your mechanism to convey your ideas, what you want to do, you stay quiet, then you don't bring the best of yourself and you diminish your possibilities. So that was a very early learning, and it was very good to develop my own mechanism, which is a mechanism that I still use today. I switch my mind and I operate like that.
Which I think is, as an introvert myself, I'm the same way of, and people are surprised because I speak for a living. I've done stand-up in the past. I've taught improv as well. And people are surprised to find that I'm introverted. But I like that framing that you said. Those two kind of frames for any of those fellow introverts listening out there. One, to the point that you spoke to of like how important it is to speak up in a business setting is to make sure that your voice is heard. And especially if you, a lot of us introverts will know what's going on. And I love that balance, like you said, is some people will talk a lot, but not necessarily have a ton of substance. And so if you are someone who has that focus, you can bring it by being prepared and not being intimidated. And then I love that focus of that reframing of thinking, okay, if this was my business, what would I do? What would I say? And I think that creates a great sense of ownership. So those, I think, are two great tips for the fellow introverts out there.
The other thing that I was very lucky to appreciate early as a site engineer on this first job in Brazil is I was extraordinarily lucky to get a team that was made of very, very bright and very, very dynamic individuals. And we got along extremely well. And in addition to the work, we were going for lunch every day together. And lunch was outside the plant, was in different locations, restaurants or cafeterias, but external. Every Thursday night, we went for our beer. So we created a friendship on top of an extraordinarily, I would say, ambitious professional set of, I would say, conditions that everybody was bringing to the table. And the power of this team and how much I was able to rely on them and how much this synergy and coming all together powered our ability to do things was a tremendous eye-opener to me. And again, as I said, I was lucky to inherit many of them. And then we were, I would say, fortunate to like each other. So one thing that I got from that is I really want a team of extraordinarily capable individuals who love working with each other. We have this additional element of we are having so much fun. We enjoy each other so much. We join externally. We are friends working together. And that is something that I try to continue replicating in future and following assignments.
Which I think is such a powerful thing to do, because I've certainly been in companies or organizations or work with people where it's like people are fine and it's okay. But then, yeah, when you do get into that environment, when you can work with some friends or you create friendships out of it, it just makes, I don't know, I think the work more enjoyable. And so I'm curious because you've worked in a number of different countries. You're fluent in four languages. You lead an organization that now spans a huge variety of cultures, and you've gone from that site engineering team in Brazil to a number of different types of teams. So what? How do you create that feeling of at least, even if not friendship, at least friendliness? How are you building these diverse and inclusive teams that like working with each other?
Well, I think we have to be selective with the team members, with the players. Right. And we need to give the opportunity to every person that is in place at the time that we arrive. But we also need to set our expectations on how we want to work. And we want to make sure that people are able to meet those expectations. And if they are not, then we need to do the changes and the adjustments. Now, being upfront, being direct, and then not caring about style, but respecting substance, it makes a long way for people to feel inclusive, included, and for people not to feel discriminated by things that might be related to your origin, the color of your skin, or the way you speak. So setting clear expectations, then giving a lot, taking full responsibility myself for the creation of the team, not blaming the team members, but then privileging completely substance and contribution versus style are some of the things that I try to do all the time. And then if somebody doesn't fit, we will need to find another place where the person fits. But the team has to become this group of synergetic friends, if you want, and that takes time.
And so I'm curious with that, because I love that kind of focus of substance over style, because everyone's going to kind of have their own styles or the way that they do things, or the way that they want to do things. But the real key is kind of the substance or the results from it. And so are these things that you then, how do you get the team on board with that? Is it that you come in and you explicitly say that? Do you write it as a value on the wall? What's the actual process of getting the team to believe in that and then not only learn what those expectations are, but then grow to meet them?
I don't write these things on the wall, but I like to insist on these things. And I like to come across as very comfortable with my own flaws and my own mistakes. When I was, I would say, in the mid phase of my career, I was product supply vice president for this baby care supply chain in Latin America. And I was invited to come to the US to lead the product supply side of the tissue and towel, the family care business. So I was all my career in LA in a business of about $500 million in sales, $50 million in profit, coming into family care, which is $5 billion in sales, $700-800 million in profit at the time. So it was a 10x increase in responsibilities. And I was invited to come. And when many people heard that I'm coming, they came to me and said, well, you are going to the general office, you are going to Cincinnati, you will need to change. You will need to change the way you talk. You will need to prepare a meeting before the meeting and be ready for a meeting after the meeting. You will need to change the way you write. And there was all these things that I was supposed to accommodate to a different style. And this was pissing me off. So I had the chance before coming to talk to the top management of the company about the move. And when I said, hey, this is what they are telling me. And the answer that I got was extraordinarily refreshing. The answer was, the you that we know is the you that we see. And that's the you that I want you in the US. If you start changing who you are, if you start changing your style, if you start making decisions on a different way, we don't know what way is that. So we don't know who you are going to be and how we are going to be able to choose you if we don't know who you are going to be. So I want you to come to the US for the advice and be yourself. Obviously, understand the fact that the business is 10 times bigger and you need to be a bit more careful with some things, but don't change anything. Be completely yourself, because that's the choice that we made. Move yourself into that place. And this was probably one of the most refreshing advices that I ever had, because it says, don't worry about style, be comfortable with the flaws that you have, obviously try to improve constantly, and make sure that the people that work for you feel the same way.
Yeah, well, I love that. I love that phrase, the you that we know is the you that we see, and that's the you that we want. It's a fun, kind of almost poetic thing to say, but exactly to your point of that, hey, there's a reason why you're being asked to come and do this. And so we want you to leverage that strength. So what a great gift to be able to give someone in terms of that, a little bit more self-assurance and to build. And then, like you said, to always be working on your flaws, be working on improvement areas and things like that, but to not completely change, because that's what you're hearing from other people. And clearly that is, you know, something that has worked, because you're now the chief product supply officer. And as I mentioned earlier, leading an organization of 58,000 people, over 100 plants, more than 200 distribution centers all around the world. And so is that intimidating, knowing that there's that many people that are in the organization? And what's your favorite aspect of having reached past that point of band three, where you would have that company car and moving well beyond that?
It's not intimidating, but it's humbling. It's something that is an extraordinarily big responsibility. And the favorite part of it to me is the one that has to do with the face-to-face direct relationships with the whole organization. So I travel a lot. Obviously, this is previous to COVID, and hopefully after COVID, we go back to that. I traveled a lot to see the people on the workplace, to see the teams, to see the manufacturing sites, the distribution centers, meet customers, meet suppliers, but to be there with the people on the place where the action happens, to be on the floor. Floor meaning the plant floor, the store to which we sell, the factory of a supplier, or the planning service center where we make different decisions. And learning from that and passing on the things that I see and having very open discussions and very brainstorming type of engagements at all levels of the organization, that's the most fulfilling piece to me. Anytime that I considered eventually in the past to perhaps leaving the company to go somewhere else, I always thought that I might do well in a different company, probably will do well with peers, will do well with management or my direct subordinates, but I will not be able to recreate 30 years getting in touch with the 58,000 people of P&G because I just don't have those 30 years. I had them with P&G, and that ability to be connected and know many, many of these 58,000 very, very well is to me the most fulfilling piece. And then obviously the responsibility to keep this huge engine operating as a top supply chain is a major, I would say, intellectual challenge every day. Is something that you need to address on a restless way. The moment that you start believing that you are the best is when you start not being the best any longer. And I am very hungry to change for improvement constantly. And when you have an organization of this size, it's an absolute must. So the people element, by going there, by interacting, by loving and caring and getting a lot out of the organization, tremendously fulfilling. The intellectual challenge to keep the P&G supply chain on the leading edge, it's also tremendously fulfilling.
Which I think is, it's a great, kind of great to hear this perspective. So certainly some of the people that we have conversations with, they have elected to leave P&G at some point and go the different directions. And we've heard from them of why they made that decision. And then we've also sometimes talked to retirees as well of like why they stayed. And so I think it's great to have that perspective because some of our listeners are reaching that stage where they're like, I've been with an organization for a while and considering, do I want to go somewhere else or elsewhere? So it's nice to hear kind of your framing of how that was, of it's still going to be challenging. It's still a good company. You want to keep it this, and also those relationships as a key point. And then the phrase of, you know, the moment you start believing you're the best is the moment you stop becoming the best. That continual improvement, I think, is really valuable, which is pretty impressive. You mentioned COVID and certainly that during the pandemic, things have changed, but that's something that P&G has actually done pretty well in terms of being able to support, because it's certainly been a very challenging time, but people need P&G's products perhaps now more than ever. And during the pandemic, P&G was able to not only increase production, but do it in a safe way with fewer staff and still give back to the community in a number of different ways as well. So my question is for you is, how was that possible? How, from a supply chain side, from product supply, were you able to increase productivity with fewer staff?
Well, what we had the chance during COVID is to test and confirm over a very long period of time, by the way, it was not a couple of weeks or months. Now we're into this for more than a year. We confirmed how critical is all this capability building that we always said and we work to have in the supply chain when a crisis happens. The reason we have been, I would say, very competent during this crisis, number one, is because of the quality of our workforce in the plants and distribution centers, and that is based on our high-performance work system and on our IWS integrated work system programs that we have been developing for decades. Right. Our workforce has been able, with a lot of management not being able to commute because of lockdowns or because of choosing to stay and work from home, we rely completely on our technician workforce to run the operations, and they run it exactly as well as before the crisis hit. Our suppliers, which we always have been building a lot of strategic relationships, and many times we question, should we be more transactional versus strategic, trying to find the right balance? In general, we are more on the strategic side. Because of that strategic relationship that we have been building for years, the proximity, they immediately adopted our protocols. They immediately gave us what I would call a preferential service on our own needs. Comes to our planning group, we have been investing in data software applications to run the supply chain end to end for the last 8 or 9 years, very, very intensely. And from one day to another, the 4,000 people that we have on the planning control towers around the world, they started to work from home. And absolutely nothing happened of negative to the quality of their work and the planning. And this is thanks to all the capability invested on these systems and applications. And then our relationship with the downstream suppliers that we have, our partners on the distribution system, has also paid out tremendously. So from our relationship with the suppliers to the self-sufficiency and the power of the high-performing team in an AWS environment, to logistics, to planning, all this came to the scene at full strength during COVID and is still there. And that is what allowed us to run and to work despite everything that happened. And then what this did was also to allow for many folks that are not on that make, pack, and ship line to say, well, we want to contribute equally. And that's when we said, well, there is a lot to do to be a force for good. How can we support the communities? How can we start developing solutions and PPIs and even ventilators that we can offer to people in need, to communities in need? So we complemented the make, pack, and ship strength, keeping people safe, with this focus on being a force for good for our communities. And we relied a lot on the people that are not on the production line or the end-to-end supply chain to help us there.
Which I think there's so much in that that like is a powerful story in kind of prepping the organization. Like you said, it wasn't a thing that just happened overnight. It's been years, not necessarily of saying planning for it, of thinking that this is going to happen, but it's been investment in, like you said, in systems and data and software. And I think one of the things that really stands out to me is also the investment in capability building, like you mentioned, with the technicians.
The people, the investment in people, the training in people, the careers that we offer through our technician system, those are absolutely fundamental.
And if I remember correctly, also seeing that part of it was, okay, developing capability for the technicians that they knew how to run multiple lines or multiple segments so that you could actually even limit the number of people in there because one person might know multiple things as opposed to being, you know, only one specific part of the process.
Yeah, that was critical. So one of the things that when we started to see the lockdowns, and this was particularly strong in the Middle East, in our fabrics in Saudi Arabia, in our fabric factory, big factory in the Philippines, in Cabuya, all of the sudden people were not able to allow to commute from different neighborhoods to the plants. So we had 50, 60% of the workforce present and available. So we said, well, when we need to develop protocols that allow us to deliver 90% of the throughput with 50% of the head force. And relying on all those skills that you mentioned, that people are multi-skilled, they know the different modules, they know the production line, we developed those systems and we rolled out globally. We didn't need to use them all around the globe, but in many locations, yes. But we were prepared to keep this going. Obviously, on a unique crisis mode, but with 50, 60% of our workforce able to supply at least 90% of the business. And what we ended doing is having much more availability of people than that and supplying much more than 90%, actually much more than 100% because the business had been growing.
Yeah, which is powerful. And then the other component to that, I think, which is an important or at least a powerful part of this story is that, like you said, by having that capability and having a smaller group being able to run a big part of it, it freed up capacity, like you said, for the people that weren't running the plants, that were working from home to say, okay, how can we think broader? How can we be this force for good, as you mentioned, and still help the community. So it's not like, okay, I'm just going to sit around and do nothing, but okay, they're running this now in this way. So over here, we can be doing these other impactful things for the business and for the community. So I think it's a wonderful kind of coming together of those resources and capabilities. And I know you mentioned that IWS, the Integrated Work System, was a big part of how that was possible. And some people I've heard refer to the IWS as kind of the daily operating system of P&G product supply. So I'm curious, what makes creating something like IWS possible? Is it just having good systems? Is there other components to it that make it a thing that actually works?
See, IWS is something that we have been developing, evolving, and making bigger over the years. So the first thing that we did was to create what we call a high-performing work system in the company. And this, I am talking now 40 years ago. So essentially, the whole idea was, instead of having a maintenance group, a production group, an electrical group, and a utilities group, and everybody does their own piece, and when the line goes down, you bring the maintenance, we said, why don't we establish self-sufficient teams that can run the supply chain autonomously? The team has all the skills. This is the essence of high-performance work system and the technician system of P&G. And we put that in place, as I say, in the late 80s. And that by itself was a breakthrough, because the skills of the team were complete to run the full shift end-to-end to troubleshoot any situation. Then we added to that a notion, which was a very, very early data analytics application. We added reliability engineering to the way we troubleshoot the performance of our production line. We started to collect, and again, I'm talking in the late 80s, collecting all the data related to the stops of the line using statistical models that helps you to go to the root cause and assess the root cause. And then we also follow by going to Japan, this is the early 90s, to understand total productive maintenance, the philosophy of the Japanese for how to run manufacturing operations with zero defects and 100% people involvement. So we brought all that technical content, we combine it with reliability engineering, and we put it in the context of high-performance work system. And by those three things being combined, we said, this is our integrated work system. And we started to progress on that integrated work system. And we keep progressing that system even today, because it started in the manufacturing. We expanded it to the end-to-end supply chain and is based on the elimination of all loss and the involvement of 100% of the workforce. And as technology comes with new solutions, today it involves a lot of artificial intelligence, data analytics, applications for automation, in addition to the other typical skills that people need to have to run a production line. So this is a very comprehensive program that keeps evolving and getting stronger. While there might be elements of the content that are available publicly on the internet, like, for example, the TPM material, the way that we have integrated all the best content through our years of experience, combined with how we codified it into an easy step-by-step implementation plan, provides a best-in-class operational excellence system for the industry, delivers superior results and superior value creation.
Well, and it sounds like as part of that, like you said, the evolution of it, the fact that it's always kind of improving, and by improving, people are more passionate about it, and by them being more passionate, new things opening in technology. So it is an evolution of things. Yeah. And it seems like ownership or buy-in from the people working is a core component of getting it done. Any thoughts on how you build that ownership, get people excited about it, is so that they want to implement this type of thing?
Well, the fundamental benefits that the technician get is they upskill themselves tremendously from a very technical perspective, which allows them to progress on the career, but also all the labor intense, all the manual work, all the work that is non-value added gets eliminated. So all of a sudden, you have a lot more time to do the more technically deep work that needs to happen to improve the equipment, the process, the operation, and the firefighting is exponentially smaller. So you get a better work environment and a ton of upskilling and training. And that is what makes our workforce very attractive out there. And that obviously requires that we reward them very well and we give them opportunities to grow. Otherwise, they are very sought after out there in the market.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a great, it's a great kind of thing for people to seek. And it's something that's clearly worked, both in terms of for the individuals and then for P&G as an organization, to the point now that P&G has partnered with EY to license the methodology to other non-compete companies. And so my question is, I guess, from a broader strategic perspective, what went into the decision to share this more broadly rather than just keep kind of IWS as its idea, like a secret locked in a vault somewhere for P&G? Why the partnership with EY?
Well, there are, I would say, three strategic reasons for us to go this way. The first, as I said, we continue to improve the program. A recent innovation that came out of our partnership with EY is our Run to Target Accelerator Playbook. It basically takes the key daily management systems and in 16 weeks of implementation already gives you a significant increase on your operational performance. The second piece is by partnering, we create a virtuous circle in which we gain some revenue that then we reinvest on further capabilities into the program itself. So all the return that we have for the commercialization of this is directed to develop additional capabilities to push for the next phases of the program and to make the program stronger, from which we benefit ourselves. Okay. And the last piece is, if you really have something that you are able to offer and sell, it's a very strong validation that the product is very good, right? So, and it pushes you to improve the product constantly. So it is attractive. And that's what we are getting essentially out of this. The other reality is this is a program that as of today has five phases. The majority of the companies that are implementing this start from phase zero, phase one, phase two, and they are on the way to, from phase one to phase two. We are in phase five.
Mm-hmm. Still the competitive advantage in some ways. But I love the strategy, especially the piece that you said of creates this virtuous cycle in the sense that you get some revenue in it, and that revenue is then put back into the system to improve the program. So it's a way of funding R&D almost in a sense of, hey, we know this is good and we're going to make it even better.
Well, all the revenue that we'd invest on this notion of constructive disruption of the program itself. And the next app, the next digital tool that allows you to go even further, a lot of other components related to automation of things that in the past were not feasible to automate. So it's definitely directed to help us to go to the following phases of the program.
I love it. So Julio, this has been fantastic. It's been great to hear both the kind of your background into what you're doing and then also the very cool things that you're up to within the organization that the team is up to. So as we start to wrap up, I'd love to take an opportunity to ask just a couple of fun questions so we get to know you even a little bit more. So my first kind of quick question is, what's your go-to media escape? Are you someone who watches movies, reads books, watches TV, something else?
Books, very much. It's probably what I enjoy the most.
Yeah. Is there a book that you've read recently that you think that you've given as a gift to a friend because you enjoyed it so much?
Yeah. I just, as I said, I came back from vacations a week ago and I had the chance to read a book, which is not, it's probably been out there for 20 years, but I read it now. It's called The Last Place on Earth. And it tells the story of the South Pole race that the Norwegian Amundsen won. And it's an extraordinary adventure, but it's also an extraordinary leadership story about humility versus charisma and competence and knowledge versus excess of resources, because this humble man, but extremely competent, wins a race versus Scott, who had all the resources and all the publicity and all the movement behind him. So great adventure, tremendous leadership lesson. And I love that type of books very much. So I would offer this to anyone.
I love it. It sounds great. I'm definitely going to pick it up. Next question is who is someone out there you'd love to have a coffee with?
Okay, many. I am a soccer fan, and I'm a fan of Lionel Messi and Barcelona. So if I could have a coffee in Barcelona with Leo Messi, that would make my day.
That is, I think that's a great selection. I was just watching, there's just yet another impressive highlight that I watched, I think, 2 days ago from him. Like, constant highlights, impressive that he's still doing so talently well over these years. So I think that I would love to listen to that conversation. And so our last question for you, Julio, because this has been fantastic. I really appreciated your time today. But our last question is, what is one final piece of advice or even perhaps a challenge that you would give to the next generation of leaders?
I would say there are things that change, but there are things that don't change. And I learned a very strong leadership model, which is based on competence, character, and caring. Competence is the power of the mind. Character and caring is the power of the heart. I would encourage them to understand that model very well and to apply that to be a successful leader. It has been tremendously powerful for me.
I like that distinction, competence, character, and caring. Well, Julio, thank you again so much for your time and for joining us for this conversation and these learnings with leaders.
Thanks to you for the opportunity. It was wonderful to have this conversation. Thank you.
And that's our show. Like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
Now, here's a preview of next week's episode.
I think anyone can become an entrepreneur. It's just, are you going to be happy doing it? And that is the key to all of this in life, is just, where does happiness lie for you? Happiness for me in entrepreneurship is this ability to solve problems that other people haven't been able to figure out. And that brings me so much joy. And the balance of that is the risk. There is so much risk in entrepreneurship. And so for anyone who finds their joy in things that are very stable and live in peace and are good with their paycheck coming in every month, that's great. So probably entrepreneurship isn't for you. But for those who really love taking risks, enjoy the thrill of high risk, high reward, entrepreneurship is a great option.
That's it for this week. I've been Andrew Tarvin.
And I'm still Roman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.